On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Because there may be it's important to distinguish between posts that are public, social media on a Facebook page, versus private communications through various social media or apps. And our law enforcement and intelligence professionals are constantly monitoring public posts. And that is part of the visa review process.
President Obama, moments ago in his last press conference of the year, talking about the challenges in rooting out would-be terrorists on social media. The first questions he fielded were on that topic as news continues to unfold about the terrorist shooting in San Bernardino 2 weeks ago. The president said social media poses challenges and opportunities when it comes to stopping terrorist attacks. Here he is.
Here, essentially, you have ISIL trying to encourage or induce somebody who may be prey to this kind of propaganda. And it becomes more difficult to see. It does mean that they're less likely to be able to carry out large, complex attacks. But as we saw in San Bernardino, obviously, you can still do enormous damage.
The president also talked about the future of Guantanamo. He said the detention center's existence helps terrorist groups like ISIS recruit support. By early next year, he wants to get the prisoner population there down to less than 100, and he says he's still determined to close it.
I'm presenting a plan to Congress about how we can close Guantanamo. I'm not going to automatically assume that Congress says no. I'm not being coy, David. I think it's fair to say that there's going to be significant resistance from some quarters to that. But I think we can make a very strong argument that it doesn't make sense for us to be spending an extra $100, $200, $300, $500 million, $1 billion, to have a secure setting for 50, 60, 70 people.
And the president went on to hit on several other topics during his relation, including his relationship with Congress and the recent climate deal struck in Paris. The press conference just wrapped up moments ago. And now he is off for a vacation in Hawaii, but he is making one stop here in Southern California along the way. Tonight, he'll be in San Bernardino meeting with the families of victims of the mass shooting. And we're getting more details about the shooters in San Bernardino. A neighbor and friend of shooter Syed Rizwan Farooq was charged yesterday with conspiring to carry out two other attacks back in 2012. According to the criminal complaint, Enrique Marquez Jr. and Farooq had plotted attacks at Riverside City College and on drivers on the 91 freeway. Those attacks were never carried out. However, new information released by investigators reveals Marquez's role in supplying Farooq with weapons and bomb-making supplies used in the San Bernardino attack. Well, joining me now is Shane Harris, senior correspondent at The Daily Beast and author of At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, so Marquez lived next door to Farooq. How did their relationship develop?
Well, what investigators believe is that they met in around 2005, and they say that it was not long after that that Mr. Farooq introduced, in their words, Marquez to Islam. It's not clear whether he had an interest in it beforehand. Friends have said he was interested in learning about the religion. But what the picture they paint, the investigators, is that Farooq then started introducing him to very extreme Islamic rhetoric. They listened to sermons by the American-born cleric Anwar al-Awlaki, who your listeners may remember was killed in a drone strike. strike a few years ago, and sort of brings Marquez into this very extremist version of Islam. I mean, the way they paint it in the indictment, it almost sounds like he sort of indoctrinated him in this. But clearly they believe Mr. Marquez was also a willing participant and didn't break off their relationship for a number of years, not till late 2012.
Yeah. So back then, back in 2005, he was a teenager, right? He was quite young.
Yeah, that's right, because he's 24 now. So I mean, he was a young kid. We've talked to a friend of his who, you know, I think it describes him as sort of like, you know, an average kind of guy. Maybe he felt a little, you know, on the outside, kind of nerdy, if you will. And he seems to have gravitated towards Farouk as maybe this kind of older brother or even mentor figure. Mm-hmm. Marquez enjoyed working on cars. That's something that he and Farouk did. And you can kind of get the sense from the complaint that Farouk is sort of bringing him under his wing, and that this is something that Marquez feels really positive about and wants to impress this guy who he appears to look up to.
Now, previously, it had been thought, one idea, one theory had been that Farouk's wife, Tashfeen Malik, had been the one to radicalize him because of her postings on social media and sort of the schools she went to in Pakistan and that she was in Saudi Arabia for a while. But what does the complaint reveal in terms of that?
Yeah, I think the complaint really blows up a lot of that narrative, frankly, about Tashfeen Malik being the kind of indoctrinator, the radicalizer. It's very clear from the allegations that Mr. Farouk was already quite radical in 2005 and then into 2007 as well. There are, you know, stories of him being the one that is showing Marquez all of this Islamic extremist kind of rhetoric and almost sort of bringing him in as somebody who was going to be his, like you get the feeling of like an apprentice and certainly an accomplice in these attacks. So the picture that investigators are painting is that Farouk was well on his way to being a radical jihadist years before he ever met the woman who became his wife.
And years before they had these other plans, one at Riverside City College and the other on the 91 freeway. Tell us about those.
Right. So the one plan at Riverside Community College, where they had both been students, they were allegedly planning to throw pipe bombs into a cafeteria area there up from an elevated position on a second floor overlooking it, and then to shoot people as they tried to flee. And then in the case of the State Route 91 attack, they were going to hit this during afternoon rush hour. And Marquez told investigators that they chose a section of the freeway where there were no exits because they felt that would increase the number of targets that they had in the lanes actually going eastbound there. The plan was they were going to throw pipe bombs on the freeway, which they thought would disable the vehicles and stop traffic, and then they would move among the stopped vehicles, shooting people in their cars. And then Marquez allegedly said he was going to be the one to watch out for law enforcement and first responders, and that he would then shoot at them to essentially try and keep away any of the life-saving medical personnel from coming to the scene. So two very ambitious and awfully terrible plots that he was confessed to being involved in or planning for them.
And why did they drop those plans?
It's not entirely clear from what we've seen in the complaint, honestly. Around late 2012, though, investigators say that Marquez starts to back away from Farouk. And one of the things that they said was very interesting was that it was prompted in part by his becoming aware of the arrest of two other men there in Southern California on material support to terrorism charges. So it seems like the narrative investigators are painting here is that Marquez starts to think twice about this, sees what happens to people who associate with these kinds of plans, and starts backing away from him. We may learn more about this, of course, as things go on, but it seems like Marquez was having second thoughts and decided not to go forward with his friend on these attacks.
And yet he had already allegedly bought the weapons that were used in the attack 2 weeks ago.
That's right. And he talked about being willing to do that, he told investigators, because the reading from the complaint here is that his appearance was Caucasian while Farouk looked Middle Eastern. So clearly he went out and did this believing that he would have an easier time buying these weapons than Farouk would have. So that occurs in late 2011, then into 2012. And then, of course, it's later in that year where this break happens. And then, of course, Mr. Farouk goes on to then get in touch with the woman who becomes his wife. And then we know what happens from there.
So Marquez alleged, according to this complaint, he didn't have anything to do with Farouk, you know, in terms of planning violent jihad in what, late 2012, early 2013. He had a break with him. And yet he married a relative of his.
That's right. In fact, this is also one of the charges against him, is engaging in a sham marriage. He married this relative apparently in order to allow her to come into the United States and obtain legal residency status, and was paid, prosecutors say, $200 a month for doing this. And I think why this is significant is because it shows you that even if he had maybe backed away from this kind of active plotting, he still is maintaining these connections to Farouk's life and to his family. And it raises the question of why, if he had this awareness and potentially even these misgivings, did he not come forward to authorities at the time and talk about it? Now, maybe he decided he was going to limit his relationship in certain ways and protect this man. But, you know, I think investigators clearly are getting a lot of information out of him, but I think are going to want to know why he didn't come forward sooner if he saw these things happening.
So then he after the attacks, he checked himself into a mental health facility.
Yeah, that's right. He in fact, we talked to one friend of his who spoke to him several times on the night of the attacks and the next day and described him as distraught. He realized quite quickly who these people were. He expressed disbelief that they did this and that they had used the guns that they had bought for him. There's some indication that maybe he thought these guns were just for target practice. That seems a little hard to believe given their previous plotting. But clearly this really shook him. And then, yes, he does check himself in and then ultimately starts cooperating with authorities.
And waives his Miranda rights, so there's no lawyer present.
Right, which, I mean, could be interesting in retrospect. I mean, that may be something that helps his defense. But, yeah, I mean, he called 911 and said that he knew the shooter and used an expletive to describe him at the time and said he'd used his gun. I don't know if Mr. Marquez was thinking he would get a better deal or what he was thinking, but clearly this really shook him when it happened.
And as you said earlier, he was listening to lectures by Anwar al-Awlaki, who, as you said, was killed by a U.S. drone strike in Yemen several years ago. Al-Awlaki has been linked to several terrorist plots. How influential is he even now, even after death?
Yeah, it seems like he continues to be influential. You know, he was linked to the Fort Hood shooting. Major Nadal Hassan had been in touch with al-Awlaki by email. Major Hassan, of course, you know, shot many people at his base there. The Boston Marathon bombers are believed to have listened to some of his lectures. You know, and he continues to sort of, I think, have this almost, you know, outsized presence and being somebody who is both, I think, seen as a martyr for his cause, but also as someone who's teachings and philosophies live on after him. So he has continued to be a very powerful figure. And obviously these two men, Mr. Marquez and Farouk, were also influenced by him. That's what Marquez is telling investigators.
Shane Harris, senior correspondent at The Daily Beast. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, Madeline. Thanks.
Coming up, did you know there's a debate tomorrow night? The Democrats are meeting at a time when most people will likely be doing other things, maybe going to a holiday party. We're going to talk about that and how Bernie Sanders had a very good day yesterday and a not so good one today, next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Democratic National Committee wants Bernie to feel its burn. It says the Sanders campaign took advantage of a software glitch and accessed internal voter data from Hillary Clinton's campaign. And so the DNC has suspended Sanders' access to its 50-state voter file. Sanders is now threatening to go to federal court this afternoon to have his access reinstated. But Bernie's week hasn't been all bad. He nabbed two endorsements and surpassed 2 million donations to his presidential campaign. And he should have a chance to talk about all of this tomorrow night at the third Democratic debate in Manchester, New Hampshire. Joining me now is Reid Wilson, chief political correspondent for The Morning Consult. Hi there.
Hi.
All right, let's kick this off by talking about this DNC kerfuffle. Here is how the communications director, Luis Miranda, described it this morning on MSNBC.
So on Wednesday, we were notified by our vendor, NGP Van, which administers our voter file system, that when they uploaded a software patch, it inadvertently allowed the campaigns on the system to access some of the data from the others. And for a very brief window, one of the campaigns inappropriately accessed data from another.
Okay, so do we know what was in that data?
No, we don't. What we're talking about here is a massive file of voter information that every presidential campaign and eventually every Senate and House and all that stuff, all those campaigns on the Democratic side are able to access. And what apparently happened is that, let me back up one more second, the campaigns themselves are able to add their own information on top of that. So, for example, if they go in and find Joe Smith's name and address and date of birth and all that, they can also put a little note in there that says that Joe Smith contributed to their campaign 2 years ago and attended an event last week in Manchester, New Hampshire, or something like that. The other campaign isn't supposed to be able to see that. What happened is the Sanders campaign was able to see some of the data that the Clinton campaign put up on their website or put up on this data file. As you heard, the firewall was apparently down for a minute or two. A brief period of time. And in that time, at least some of the data was exposed.
Okay. And so now the DNC is saying, well, Bernie Sanders, you no longer have access to this file. Is it very important that he have access?
It is hugely important that Sanders has access to this file. And as a matter of fact, it's not just the data from the DNC that Sanders would have access to. It's his own campaign's data. The campaigns themselves are uploading their information that they collect onto this third-party vendor called NGP Van that you heard Louis Miranda mention there. And now, at the moment, Bernie Sanders doesn't have access to his own data. There are really only 7 weekends left, starting tomorrow, between now and the Iowa caucuses. And if the Bernie Sanders campaign doesn't know who it's supposed to be calling, who it's supposed to be talking to, who it's supposed to be knocking on the door of, I mean, that's a massive problem. You can't run a campaign without doing the number one thing that a campaign does, which is communicating with voters.
All right, here's Jeff Weaver, Sanders campaign manager, talking about that at a press conference today. Let's listen.
In other words, by their action, the leadership of the Democratic National Committee is now actively attempting to undermine our campaign. This is unacceptable. Individual leaders of the DNC can support Hillary Clinton in any way they want, but they are not going to sabotage our campaign, one of the strongest grassroots campaigns in modern history. We are announcing today that if the DNC continues to hold our data hostage and continues to try to attack the heart and soul of our grassroots campaign, we will be in federal court this afternoon seeking immediate relief.
Okay, so Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who runs the DNC, said, you know, look, if it had happened the other way around, Sanders' campaign would have wanted this kind of sanction. And is there anything to that, the fact that the Sanders campaign says that the DNC is being unfair?
No, I think the Sanders campaign is exactly right in this instance. This is a draconian punishment. I mean, this is like the death penalty for campaigns. If you don't have access to the data that they've been working for months to build, you can't run a campaign. You simply don't know who you're communicating with or talking to, especially in a contest like the Iowa caucuses where, you know, only about 150,000 people are going to turn out. If you're not talking to those 150,000 people, you're wasting your time. This isn't a slap on the wrist. This is, you know, this is the death penalty.
And are they saying how long this sanction will last?
No, they haven't. And I think this is another problem with the Democratic National Committee. Here in Washington, there are 6 major, 8 major political party committees, committees that operate over the national party, which is like the DNC and the RNC, and then separate committees for the Senate, the House, and governor's races. And what we've really seen over the last decade is that the DNC itself has become a shell. I mean, it's barely more than a building just south of the Capitol building here. It's one of the worst-run committees in the country. It is millions of dollars in debt and largely hasn't played a role in recent presidential campaigns. President Obama really took over a lot of the functions that the DNC did and ran those through his own campaign. So the DNC itself is finally relevant for the first time in quite a while, and they're screwing this up right now.
And this is not the first time that the DNC has been accused of playing footsie with the Hillary Clinton campaign by the Sanders campaign. I mean, they're saying the very reason that the debates are scheduled on a Saturday night is to ensure low viewership and to help out Hillary Clinton.
Two debates in a row have been held on Saturday night. On the Republican side, we've seen amazing ratings, you know, 16, 20 million people tuning in to watch these debates, to watch Republicans offer their policy solutions for the country. Democrats, meanwhile, have seen, you know, they had a pretty good debate the last time around. I think it was about 8 million or so. But still, that's a fraction of the number of people who are tuning in to the Republican debates. And the Sanders campaign and the campaign of Martin O'Malley, the former governor of Maryland, who, despite the poll numbers, is also in the race, they're complaining that, hey, they're not getting any airtime. They're not getting the access and the oxygen necessary to really take off. You know, that complaint has a lot of merit.
So in the last debate, Bernie Sanders was pretty nice to Hillary Clinton. What do you think is going to happen now?
Bernie Sanders is not the kind of candidate who attacks a lot. He's, you know, watching the Republican debate, you see Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio offering specific votes that the other one took, and therefore that's evidence that they're not the right candidate or something like that. Bernie Sanders really isn't running that campaign. He's running a campaign that is more issue-based and issue-focused. That's not exactly how you win in this day and age of sort of soundbite politics, but it's the way that that Sanders is running. It sort of shows that he is I don't say this in a pejorative way, but a one-issue candidate, a guy who wants to talk about income inequality and things like that. But, you know, he hasn't really gone after Clinton. I don't really expect him to, although he would be well within his right to mention this and this incident that's happened today.
Well, and so would she, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the smartest thing that Hillary Clinton could do right now is to demand that the DNC give him access and by the way, throw open their doors and say, sure, here's our data, too. They're not going to do that, obviously. But, this is something that, that makes the Clinton campaign look bad by association with the DNC, which looks really bad.
Reed Wilson, chief political correspondent for The Morning Consult. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
All right, so how will you be spending your Saturday night? Will you be watching the Democratic debate or doing something else? DVR to the rescue, let us know. Call us 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can talk to us on Facebook, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, Bernie Sanders has a fan in Killer Mike, the Atlanta rapper. We'll talk about Killer Mike and the resurgence of political rap. Also, Star Wars, it's everywhere.
It is an asteroid hitting the culture. Whether it's good or bad depends on whether you're a dinosaur or a mammal.
Star Wars and more in our weekly film roundup. That's after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, the same guy responsible for this.
You can fuss, you'll become fear, there'll become dust. Before this moment, you didn't mean much. You are the smoldering vessel.
Yeah, those are cat noises. Well, that same guy is also responsible for this.
This country is started as an act of political protest. Right. This country is started as an
right.
act. And I'll be damned if I don't encourage every friend of mine to vote based on the fact of we should be honoring that because it transforms.
It strikes me that if you don't participate in the political process, you're really crapping on people who gave their lives to defend this country
Absolutely.
And world.
All right, that is Bernie Sanders being interviewed by the rapper Killer Mike, a.k.a. Michael Render. He dropped a 6-part interview with Sanders on his YouTube channel this week. Killer Mike is leading a mainstream revival of the political rap artist, according to the New Republic's Bijan Steven. And Bijan is here now. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline. Thank you for having me.
It's nice to have you. So we get these interviews between Killer Mike and Bernie Sanders this week, and also some images of him eating soul food with Sanders in Atlanta. Those mm-hmm. images went viral. So what's happening there? Is Killer Mike really into Bernie Sanders and trying to get his supporters to rally behind him?
From the looks of it, yes. I mean, I think when I was down there in Atlanta with Mike, we talked a little bit about politics on my last night there. I think it was almost 1 a.m. in the studio, and he was recording, and we sat down and did this nice interview. And at the end, he was telling me how politically motivated he was, and how the gist of it was he really likes authenticity in politics. And, you know, he himself was considering a run, I think, for local office, maybe I think it was state representative a few months ago, and that made some music news. But from the looks of it, it seems like he's thrown his weight behind Bernie Sanders, which it doesn't surprise me. And I think it is totally sincere.
Well, it kind of surprises me because Bernie Sanders, when he spoke, you know, earlier this year, he was protested at one of his speeches by black activists. And mm-hmm. then there was that hashtag Bernie so white. And, you know, he's been criticized for not, you know, not receiving the same kind of black support as, let's say, Hillary Clinton has, or not at showing up for the black community the way she has over the years.
Yeah, I mean, I think Bernie shows this a willingness to adapt and to listen to other perspectives. I don't think everyone gets it right all the time, but I think, to his credit, I think it seems like he's evolving. I think these conversations with Mike are part of that transition.
Well, how important is it that Killer Mike is a Bernie Sanders supporter for Bernie Sanders in terms of how influential Killer Mike can be with young black voters?
I think it's very important. I mean, I mean, Mike he's been around the hip hop scene forever, and he's very well known in the hip hop community and around Atlanta also. He's a very local sort of well-known figure down there. I think I mentioned this in my piece, but we went to see Big Boy perform at some after party, and we walked into the hotel where it was being held, and everybody knew his name, and I couldn't tell who he knew and who he was friends with and who was a stranger, because everyone knew him and he was extremely, you know, friendly and sincere. I mean, personally, I think that endorsement means a lot. I think Killer Mike, he's very sincere about this, and I think that's a big deal.
Okay, so for those of us who have never heard of Killer Mike, give us a primer. Who is he?
So Killer Mike is a 40-year-old rapper who's been around for a few decades. He's been rapping since he was a teenager in Atlanta. He was briefly a part of the Outkast entourage, Outkast being Andre 3000 and Big Boy, who you may have heard of.
Yeah, they're
amazing.
Huge
discography. Yeah. They're so big. And afterward released solo records during that period also. But most recently, he has become well-known because of his partnership with LP, otherwise known as Jamie Moline, who is an independent rapper and label owner who's been very well-known in the New York indie scene for quite some time now. They're both 40.
And he's white.
He's white.
Yeah.
This is yes, and they're best friends, like legitimately best friends, and together they are Run the Jewels.
Bunches and bunches, punches is thrown into your frontless, oodles and noodles, bang bullets at suckers' noodles. Last album, Voodoo, proved that we brutal. I'm talking crazy, half past the clock is cuckoo, you rappers do.
They make fun music that's great to listen to, easy to listen to, fun to party to, but also has a lot of introspective and political themes.
Okay, and to that point, they really went viral when they played a show in St. Louis the same night that the authorities announced that they would not indict Darren Wilson for killing Michael Brown, the police officer. Yeah. Darren Wilson. And that video of Killer Mike at that performance, Killer Mike gives a speech before the concert begins, and it seems like he's just speaking off the cuff, and I just want to play a clip from that video.
If I die when I walk off this stage tomorrow, I'm gonna let you know this. It is not about race. It is not about class. It is not about color. It is about what they killed him for. It is about poverty. It is about greed. And it is about a war machine. So I might go tomorrow. I might go the day after. But the one thing I want you to know, it is us against the mother machine.
So you can hear that he's really, really emotionally affected. This is really raw. I think earlier in the tape, you actually see him crying. And, you know, he says, "You got me today. You got me today," talking about the machine. I want you to talk about the way he was able to really capture the way people were feeling right after the non-indictment of Darren Wilson.
I mean, it was clearly not it was clearly unconscious. This was something he'd been thinking about, something he'd been expecting, I think, I mean, as far as the non-indictment goes. And I think all of, most black people know where they were when they heard that verdict come down. And I think Mike, even though I saw it later, I think he was really just responding to, very primally, to the ambient awareness of this injustice. And yeah, it was, it was a huge deal. Hmm. It was very affecting to watch, even afterward. If you watch the whole clip, you hear the music come in, and it's like this extremely cathartic moment. The crowd is, you know, I think there are people in tears in the crowd, too. And yeah. It's a very powerful visual because it's Mike up there, I think, with Jamie, who is white, and they're, you know, like, he's just speaking directly from his heart and his soul and his experience. And I think he, earlier in the speech, he mentions his sons and how powerless he feels to defend them against this, what he calls the machine. More than anything, that was probably the most potent reaction that I saw to the verdict.
So he has been, as you say, rapping for a long time. Was he always political?
That's a good question. I think yes. I mean, I would say political rap has always been around, and I think Mike is exemplary of this because there was a time between the mid to late 90s and early 2000s, really, to the 2010s, where political rap wasn't in the mainstream, and whereas before it had been, that was sort of how the genre came about. It was music for black people and by black people. And I think Mike's oeuvre has reflected that. He's very... Some of his songs have been explicitly political, for example, like Reagan, which is a hell of a song. Ronald Reagan was an actor, not at all a factor, just an employee of the country's real masters. Just like the Bushes, Clinton and Obama, just another talking head telling lies on teleprompters. If you don't believe the theory, then argue with this logic. Why did Reagan and Obama both go after Gaddafi? We invaded sovereign soil. Quite an indictment of that particular president. And he raps about his experience in Atlanta, and he, you know, there are party songs. I think it's a chronicle of his experience as a person, especially, and a black man, and as a black man in the world. So I think, yeah, he's always been political. He's always been sort of, but he's always, I mean, he's fun. He's not like just a serious sort of pontificating rapper.
So when you think of the serious pontificating rapper, you or I think of Public Enemy. As sort of the political rappers.
That, yep, that's the...
I mean, fight the power. We got to fight the powers that be. Fight the power. 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 Can't get more obviously nope. Political than that. Is he influenced by them?
I dare you to find a rapper who's not influenced by Public Enemy.
But there's so many rappers who don't rap about politics or about the social condition, oh, and they're talking about
of course.
Partying,
I mean,
and all that.
If you're talking about like the political themes, I think most rappers who want to talk about social conditions or the political atmosphere or process that began there, sort of. In a very real, like, radio play, like, underground radio play sense.
Mm-hmm. And then it kind of retrenched and rap and hip-hop became mainstream. And so are you saying that now there's been a resurgence of political rap?
I mean, I wouldn't call it a resurgence. I just think that more and more often popular artists are starting to talk about political things in their music. I mean, you hear it now on the radio. Like, you see people in the club, or I guess 2 years ago when Yeezus came out, you saw people dancing in the club to New Slaves, which is a song that has a lot of complex themes, but also a very dope beat. My mama was raised in the era when clean water was only served to the fairer skin. Doing clothes you would have thought I had help, but they wasn't satisfied unless I picked the cotton myself. You see, it's broke. Race him, that's that, don't touch anything in the stove. And it's rich, erase him, that's that, come in, please buy mo. Like, Kendrick Lamar is nominated for I don't know how many Grammys this year, and To Pimp a Butterfly it's an unapologetically black record. It's like he's speaking directly out of the black experience. So it seems like it's becoming more popular, but I really think that, like, it's impossible to ignore. Artists respond to the world via their art.
So they can't I mean, they have to address it, even if maybe they haven't done it in the past. Now they feel an urgency to address it in their work.
I think there's, I wouldn't say they have to. I mean, I think there's a new urgency. I mean, obviously, it's directly related to the last 3 years. It's directly tracked with the rise of Black Lives Matter activists and people on the streets in like protesting, saying, you know, this is the way things are not okay. And I mean, it's a very powerful thing. Like, you also see artists going down to places like Ferguson to hang out with the protesters and go march. And I think it's just become impossible to ignore for Black people in America. It feels like the reinvigoration of the civil rights movement.
Bijan Stephen is an associate editor at The New Republic, where you can read his article on Killer Mike and political rap. Bijan, thank you.
Yep, thank you.
All right, and coming up on the program, it is movie time, and yes, we're going to talk about it, plus a couple of other movies brave enough to open opposite Star Wars. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Star Wars is the Death Star of film this week, annihilating news of all other movies. But we are going to change that right here and right now with Devin Faraci. He runs the pop culture and movies website, Birth, Movies, Death. Hi there.
Hello.
And Amy Nicholson, chief film critic for LA Weekly. Hi there.
Hello.
Together, you guys host this podcast called The Canon.
Sure do.
So check it out. Free download. All right. We're not even going to play a clip of tape. We're not even going to do that. We're just going to go right into it. We're going to launch into it. Devin, I know you're a huge fan. What did you think?
I thought it was okay.
Just okay?
It was pretty good. You know, it's well made. It's fast. The new characters are great. Love the new characters. Love Finn and Rey and Kylo Ren and BB-8. Really enjoy them. It's almost exactly the same movie as the first Star Wars.
Which is maybe a good thing, considering, you know, some of the
Well, it's
flops.
Not as bad as the prequels, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it's certainly a return to form, but it's almost literally a return to form.
Oh.
So on some level, if you kind of wanted to go to a galaxy far, far away and discover new things, not this time. You're going to see a lot of really familiar things and have a lot of really familiar story beats, which in a movie that's mostly about nostalgia, maybe is exactly what the nostalgia crowd wants.
Yeah, you sense J.J. Abrams trying to play it safe. He's thinking, everyone's really disappointed about the three prequels. What can I do to just come in and make them feel, A, welcomed back into the Star Wars universe, and B, have nobody walk out saying, what was that? What did he just do to my favorite franchise?
Yeah, that's tough. He's got a tough line to walk there. Right?
He does. In my review, I compared it to, I compared the inner workings of Lucasfilm to All About Eve, because you sense him just like saying, oh, George Lucas, how can I be like you? But how can I update this just enough so that people think I'm cooler?
And you also compare George Lucas to L. Ron Hubbard.
I mean, you kind of have to. These are two men who took silly sci-fi pop novels and spun it into a religion.
Mm.
And then they went overboard and added space particles and space dinosaurs and mucked up everything. And now J.J. Abrams has to step in and fix it.
I think in a lot of ways it's sort of he updated it to the real modern moment, which is this Star Wars is kind of the remix of the original Star Wars, which makes it very much of the moment. This is remix culture, and J.J.'s taken the stuff we know from that's very familiar and put a little bit of auto-tune on it and made it a little bit different.
But people love it so much. Are they going to care?
It's going to hit the right notes. People will walk out happy.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody's going to walk out transformed, but they'll walk out happy.
And what about this whole, you know, prescription on revealing spoilers? I mean, there's this whole campaign on the web that if you even talk about it, you are committing some mortal sin.
Are there major things that happen in this movie? So I do think it's fair to not ask people to reveal elements of the end mm-hmm. of the film. Abrams is known for his
but
mystery
anything.
Box.
But anything. I mean, well, you're not even supposed to talk about the characters.
It's crazy. Abrams is known as for his mystery box way of promoting movies, which is to keep everything totally secret. It's kind of dumb here because the whole movie is just a New Hope all over again, except there are a couple of major events that – but like as in any movie that you wouldn't want to reveal.
Yeah.
So I think people are going a little overboard because I think your average human being understands, oh, you would never tell somebody that.
I think people want to go into the theater and feel like a kid again where they were, you know – 7 years old, sat down in the theater for the first Star Wars and had no idea what they were about to see. At least this isn't as ridiculous in the J.J. Abrams mystery box world as the second Star Trek, or he wouldn't even admit that Benedict Cumberbatch was Khan.
Well, I think the funny thing is that most people who are really interested in the no spoiler thing grew up in a world where there always was Star Wars. So Star Wars was like, it just always existed. They always knew that Vader was Luke's dad. So it existed in a spoiler context anyway. People go overboard with this stuff. I don't get it. I think they're a little bit OCD about it personally.
Devin, you love Star Wars. Amy, you sort of love Star Wars, the phenomenon, but you're kind of shaking.
I had a lightsaber as a kid and a bunch of toys and a Darth Vader head.
All right, well, good enough. But, I mean, this whole taking over the culture thing, is it too much? That's a loaded question.
It's a hard question because there's a certain there's two answers to this, and maybe this would be too long, but there is something about our current niche culture where everybody has their own thing going on, where nobody watches the same TV shows, that everybody comes together and there's one thing that everybody's excited about. It's really cool. We don't have that anymore. That sense that there's like an item in the culture that everybody knows about.
Yeah.
Because pop culture is so shattered, TV is so shattered. On the other hand, it is exhausting. So it's a little bit good, a little bit bad. I get excited seeing people who are all together into one thing. It feels like there's a community going on. On the other hand, shut up already.
So you're saying that Star Wars is the Michael Jackson of Hollywood?
It sort of is. There's nothing else like Star Wars in the history of movies, for sure. And it is one of the it is an asteroid hitting the culture. Whether it's good or bad depends on whether you're a dinosaur or a mammal.
Oh, very good. Okay, dare we move on?
We do dare.
Okay. All right. So there's an anti-Star Wars movie out today. I mean, it's kind of boggles the mind to think that any movie would open opposite Star Wars. But anyway, so be it. Sisters, it's a relatively low-budget comedy from Tina Fey and Amy Poehler. And there's a loose plot, I believe. Their parents are selling their childhood home, and they're going to throw one last party.
Oh, man, who called the cops?
Having a pretty big party, huh?
Oh, is 500 people too much?
Popo! Popo! Oh, somebody call a stripper? You gonna take your clothes off for us? You can't come in here without the judge signing the thing. This is where I live. This is our house.
Yep.
This is where we live, okay? And this is our property for the next 24 hours. A lot of sex is gonna happen. A lot of sexy times. You can't stop that. Last time I checked, sex wasn't against the law. As much as you would love that, wouldn't you? Why don't you step off, Lou?
Okay, so that's Amy Poehler. She sounds a little wasted. So, Amy Nicholson, what do you think?
I mean this in the best possible way, that this movie is terrifically dumb. We don't get a lot of dumb party movies starring women. In fact, I can't think of another big, dumb party movie where two women in their 40s, that's who their characters are supposed to be playing, just go absolutely nuts and raging drunk and insane. Sisters is a movie that is no better or worse than any other party movie, and I think that's almost why I like it. They just said, oh, here's that dumb party movie arc that everyone likes, where there's going to be the foam and there's going to be the drunkenness and the cops and the makeouts. We're just going to do that with Amy Poehler, who's my spirit animal. I worship Amy Poehler. So it was almost hard to sit down into this movie because the first third of it, it's a little disappointing. It was the first time I've ever watched an Amy Poehler film and thought, oh, I'm restless and I don't like who these characters are and what's happening. But as soon as the drugs come out, this movie just is so magically moronic. I had a blast. I was sitting here giggling while you were playing that clip again.
What do you think, Devin?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. The opening act of this movie is among the worst I have seen in a long time. But if you make it through that, you are rewarded with a very good, dumb comedy. That's a lot of fun. They're really great. I think Tina Fey is really incredible in this. There's a vision that we have of Tina Fey as sort of the smart, ditzy Liz Lemon thing that she goes the exact opposite of here. She's definitely much more of a long fingernails, bouffant hair, a crazy lady. And she really gets into it and really works. I love their relationship. And the comedy is as stupid as you would want. I mean, you're definitely not getting some kind of nuanced thing, but that is half the fun.
So this sort of man-child movie of yore has now been replaced by the woman-child movie of now, because you have Bridesmaids, right? You have, what else, Obvious Child, Trainwreck.
You have it on TV with Broad City.
Right.
You have these women who just refuse to grow up. And so they're doing a lot of the same stuff that we're kind of sick of Seth Rogen doing much more charming now in this different context.
Right. I guess this is the new face of female liberation. We can be just as dumb as the boys.
Oh, yay.
But Poehler and Fey just make such a great combo. You know, they've been working together for so long that when they're on screen, they just have to look at each other and you feel these years of intimacy. They can play sisters so well, even though they look nothing alike.
And Maya Rudolph is also in it. So it seems like a cast from Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, just transplant it over. Yeah. Although my favorite person in the cast, if we're getting into the supporting members, is John Cena, the wrestler. You might remember John Cena when he popped up this summer in Amy Schumer's Trainwreck, where he played her lover who just burst into Chinese while they're intimate together. And he made up all of that Chinese on the spot, and then he shows up here, and he's also just this improvisational comic genius. John Cena just steals the whole movie.
Really? And he's enormous, and he has face tattoos.
He's covered in face tattoos, and he plays this drug dealer that Tina Fey just wants to seduce and just tries to climb over him like he's a tree. And the entire time, he's just standing there impassive. This guy can do so much just standing still.
So is anyone going to actually see this weekend?
No.
No.
I mean, I just can't. It's a wonderful gesture to open a picture against Star Wars. I think any box office on Sisters is a victory, frankly. And it's a good movie. It's a good people should see it. It's hard to imagine. Star Wars is so four quadrant that it's hard to imagine there's that much of a counter-programming thing going on.
Okay. Well, speaking of the incredible opposite, this is the ultimate in counter-programming, Son of Saul, a Hungarian film about a man in Auschwitz trying desperately to find someone to give a young boy killed in the gas chamber a proper burial. And I believe it's a front runner for the Foreign Film Oscar. Okay, so we got a sense there of what happened. Spoiler alert: there's a lot of death.
That really
destruction.
It's an extraordinary motion picture. It is. I mean, there's this thing. There's this knee-jerk reaction. Oh, it's a Holocaust movie. Like, oh, I bet it's really important. It's really important, not just in terms of being a Holocaust movie. And I think it tells an interesting story in the Holocaust. It's about the capos, the Jewish prisoners who worked, under the Nazis to deal with the gas chambers, literally clean out the bodies. But on top of that, cinematically, the entire film is told from the point of view of its lead, Saul, and it's shot over his shoulder. And so the perspective of the camera is the perspective of what he's seeing. It's incredible. It really feels like a step forward in cinematic storytelling. On top of that, it's wrapped in this incredibly harsh and honest view of what Auschwitz is like. And more than any kind of 3D or anything else, this perspective puts you into Auschwitz with him. You feel like you are there. It surrounds you. It encompasses you. It's a tough watch, but it's a good watch, and it's an important movie.
Yeah, it captures both the confusion of being in the camps in these days and also the oppressive death. Because what the camera does is it keeps the focus so firmly on our lead that all of the bodies in the background, the people who are being herded into the showers, the people who are being dragged out, the ashes, are almost out of focus. And you get the sense that you're inside of his head where he's surrounded by so much death and misery, he can't even see it for what it is and he can't comprehend it. And it just puts you right inside of his brain.
There are so many Holocaust movies out, and I have to say, seeing this thing, oh my gosh, another Holocaust movie, why do I want to see yet another one?
It really is a piece of the Holocaust that I feel like we've not seen before. It's almost procedural in the way the movie opens with the trains coming to Auschwitz, walking people in through the gas chambers and out, and then dealing with the lives of these capos. You get a real understanding of how the camp worked. You get a real understanding of the dehumanization that happens. This summer, I had the opportunity to go visit the Holocaust Memorial in Jerusalem, Yad Vashem, and they walk you through this similar stuff, and I got the same feeling of incredible immersion. Like, I understood for the first time things about that. I grew up in New York City around Holocaust survivors, but I understood for the first time the feelings of being in this camp in a way that I never had, no matter previously how many Holocaust movies I had seen before. It is totally immersive.
And sure, it might not have a hopeful message or a happy ending for that matter, but I think the filmmaker says that, look, there are things worse than death, and that is losing your humanity, and he is trying to give his main character a shred of his humanity back.
I think that's absolutely true, but at the same time, he lets him be a human being, which I think is a story we don't always see also in these concentration camp movies. This is a character who has to do some complicated things to get to his end goal, and yet you understand the murkiness of his own situation, and I think it's a really tough line that the film walks.
The actor we haven't seen before, this is a first-time filmmaker, I understand?
Yes, it's a first-time filmmaker, I think, but these are people that we've not seen particularly on our screens before. The actor himself, he's previously appeared with a giant, big, bushy beard in other movies. It looks totally different in this film. And he really creates this hollowed-out central presence that is semi-passive enough that allows you to attach yourself to him and ride with him through this hellish landscape. It's so extraordinary. And this guy is doing a lot of acting with the back of his head, frankly, because so much of the movie is sort of POV over his shoulder. And he's able to get across just so much with just basic body language. It is a stunning performance.
Okay, Son of Saul. Hopefully a few people will see that this weekend. Maybe next weekend.
Maybe next weekend.
Okay.
They'll have some chances. It's definitely going to be in the Oscar conversation.
Amy Nicholson, chief film critic at LA Weekly. Devin Faraci, founder of the pop culture and movie website Birth, Movies, Death. And together they host the podcast The Canon. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Julie Myers.
Hello.
Also, no one's going to be watching the Democratic debate because of Star Wars.
You know what? That's actually a really good point.
Yeah. Mira, at Mira Manic, made that point to me on Twitter.
Oh, thanks, Mira. Brilliant, Mira. Meanwhile, on Twitter, I was pointed to by KCRW's Monica Scott the fact that Killer Mike and his rap group, Run the Jewels, have some holiday apparel on their website.
Oh.
And they refer to it as Run the Yules. And I'm just actually, I know you guys can't see this, but I'm showing Madeline right now. It's an ugly
it's a Christmas sweater
with the two wrappers on it, and it's pretty glorious. I'll retweet it out in just a moment so you guys can all have the same kind of fun that Madeline and I are having in here.
Yeah, you know what to get me.
Oh, will it make it before Christmas? So we talked about this idea that every single detail of the Star Wars movie can be construed as a spoiler. Even saying whether you liked it or hated it is getting the spoiler treatment, which that is overboard, people. Knock it off.
It's a movie.
That is true. But you liked it or hated it? Come on. Our listeners, however, were completely divided on this. It was actually really interesting. A lot of times our listeners lean one way or the other. Nope, not so here. Daniel Gamboa on Facebook says that revealing anything is, in fact, a spoiler. No question about it. Keep it to yourself. But Ever Morales says that the spoiler police are totally overreacting here. You're going to see it, and then you're going to see it over, and then you're going to see it over and over and over and over. If reading any tiny detail about the movie inspires you to lose your mind, that is your problem, not ours. Dana Elaine says, spoiling revealing plot points is the worst. Small details aren't a big deal. If you don't want to know the plot, just log off for the week. Can you even do that anymore?
I don't think
you
can.
Can you be, like, completely
logged off? You cannot.
Well, actually, we did have a comment of someone who did that. Erica Schwartz says that there are just some movies that she just doesn't care if they're spoiled, but this one, she was very, very concerned about knowing any details, so she purposely stayed off the internet so that she would not stumble on any spoilers, which I gotta say, she must have won the week with that, or lost the week. If you want to be part of the cultural conversation.
All right. Thank you, Julie Myers. Spoiler alert. It's the end of the year. And this is the last time I will be hosting this show this year. Barbara Bogave will be here next week. And then we'll have some great best of shows for you. So happy new year, everyone. I'll see you in 2016.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation, Rick and Suzanne Kane, and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane.